In the movie Gimme Shelter, you know that the song Under My Thumb is the one that the Stones were performing at the time that Meredith Hunter was stabbed to death by the Hell's Angels. And you know, there are some people, I think I even got a tweet to this effect that just sort of said, hey, you know, this guy chose to bring a gun to the concert and, you know, makes him less of a victim. I think this is where we're missing some of the context of what happened before all of that. And that's where we come back into our conversation with Just a Shot Away, Peace, Love, and Tragedy with the Rolling Stones at Altamont. Saul Austerlitz explains the various aspects of which you may not even be fully aware regarding what happened next. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So I think we've done a pretty good job setting up the most of the important aspects of this concert. Bands had come and gone that had said they were going to be a part of it. Locations had moved from what had been the original place, which would have been much more manageable, to this racetrack at Altamont. It was just everything about this in hindsight seems so obvious. And one of those was the idea that the Rolling Stones and the promoters of this concert would pay the Hell's Angels in beer to provide security for the band. So it wasn't that they were providing security for the whole crowd. They were just sort of formed a phalanx maybe in front of the stage to keep people from rushing up to the stage while they were performing, because it was kind of a small stage.
Well, part of the challenge was that, so initially the show was going to be at Golden Gate Park, where at least the local bands had some experience of playing. And then it was going to be at a place called Sears Point, where they didn't have experience of playing, where they had had some time to think through how they'd put on the show, and they custom built a stage. The stage was going to be kind of placed in a niche that would be well above the crowd. So even if the crowd got really close, they wouldn't really be able to reach the band. And then that Sears Point gets canceled just a few days before. And I think there are a lot of questions that can be raised about why no one says, hey, let's pull the plug on the show. Right. We just can't do it.
Bad juju.
Instead, they move to Altamont, where there is no rise. And so the bands are essentially 3 feet above the audience who can just reach up to the stage. And so I think some of the hope is that the Hell's Angels will protect the bands from fans who are out of control or being wild or trying to interrupt the show.
And so they were known, they were paid in beer, but what roughly how much were they paid for this? Roughly $500 or something in beer?
$500, yeah.
Yeah. And they were drinking their profits. they were self-admittedly at least semi-intoxicated, if not fully drunk, as the Rolling Stones took the stage. And so,
yeah, I mean, they had been intoxicated for most of the day and had also brought their own drugs and been doing those. So I think it's safe to say that they were, you know, intoxicated in a variety of ways and, you know, much, much earlier in the day than by the time the Stones go on.
And they're supposed to be the ones that are keeping things calm. There's nothing about their demeanor, their natural demeanor. The Hell's Angels are not known for diffusers, right? Or like trained crowd managers. They would have been the type to provide security through intimidation, strictly intimidation, not just by reputation intimidation, but also by physically assaulting people and bringing their own types of weapons like knives and chains, which is essentially like a brawl. It's just like a bar fight or, you know, a kind of a gang fight in an alleyway.
Yeah, I mean, they brought their own pool cues to assault people with. And the situation with Meredith Hunter, while is by far the most tragic, is not the only encounter between the Hell's Angels and fans over the course of the day. And you know, looking at some of the footage that the Maisels brothers and their cinematographers shoot, talking to some of the people who were present at the concert and were located relatively close to the stage, the Hells Angels were assaulting people all day long.
Right.
You know, pretty much from the start of the show, they're beating people up. They're, you know, physically assaulting people. They are being aggressive in a way that is clearly unnecessary. You know, it's not to say that there weren't audience members who were themselves high on drugs,
Of
who were
course.
themselves, you know, interrupting the show or disrupting people's enjoyment of the show. But the Hells
And
Angels, like you're saying, are a group who are fundamentally dedicated to the idea that physical aggression is their right and their responsibility, and that that's how they behave in the world. And I think even more than that, there was this idea that being at this concert was a chance for some of the bikers who were there to prove themselves. And this is by no means to let the Hells Angels off the hook. If anything, it's to the contrary. But you know, a lot of the bikers who were present at the concert were themselves kind of like probationary members of the group, and so they saw it as a chance to prove their bona fides to the
Right.
people who would decide whether they'd get to be full-on members of the Hells Angels. And so, you know, lashing out and being violent and physically aggressive, I think a lot of them saw that as their big opportunity.
Yeah, how much ass can you kick here to get yourself into a, you know, good standing with the leaders of the thug group that was there, not then at that point to provide security, but to disrupt security, to disrupt everybody's security except for their own. And you can't underestimate that because, you know, especially now when we look at the role of police at concerts or hired security, you know, there's a reason why certain people are there to keep the peace, not to prevent the peace. And that's where the Hells Angels obviously had seen that that was their right to do that. And one of those people that drew their attention, and rightfully so, is this guy Meredith Hunter, who's there with his girlfriend, with his white girlfriend, and another couple. And he has a big afro, and he's wearing a lime green suit. And he himself is well. What do we know he had ingested that day? What kind of drugs had he taken, or what had he been drinking?
We don't know a lot about that. I do, in terms of standing out, though, I do want to say that again, it kind of speaks to the specifics of the racial dynamic in that, you know, there were vanishingly few African Americans who were part of the counterculture, vanishingly few who would have been present even at a giant show like Altamont. And so for, you know, a group like the Hells Angels, who themselves were pretty unabashedly racist, I think that someone like Meredith Hunter, who was quite eye-catching in and of himself, would really have stood out and attracted their attention.
And their ire, and
Yes.
that's yeah. So I don't mean to play that down at all, but it has the fact that he becomes their focus as opposed to the, you know, 300 other mouthy white kids that were acting out all around him, who were also doing many of the same things that he was doing, but he becomes the one that they single out. At the same time, he was being disruptive because that's on the film. We can see in Gimme Shelter, we can see what he does, which is essentially to mount one of the speakers.
I agree with what you're saying, but I would say that I don't know that I would describe that as being disruptive. I think
Okay.
if you look at the concert footage that we see from the Maisels brothers, there are people who are engaged in what I would describe as being unsafe behavior. You know,
Right.
they're climbing things they shouldn't be climbing. They're trying to get a better perspective from the you know, testimony of people who were close to the stage. It was a very uncomfortable situation. People were crowded way too close together. You know, everyone was very jealously guarding the little space they had. There was a lot of pushing. People were uncomfortable. And so I think that part of that was that lots of people, definitely not just Meredith Hunter, were kind of looking for anywhere where they could have a little bit more elbow room. And from what Meredith Hunter was doing, all he seemed to be doing was standing on some sort of speaker box, which, you know, given the kinds of, you know, acid freakouts that people were having, stripping off their clothes and running naked, all kinds of other stuff, like, I don't even know if I would describe that as a disruption. I would just describe that as, you know, marking out a tiny bit of territory to just be a little bit more comfortable during the show.
Yeah, I accept that. I guess what I'm trying to say is, based on at least what I saw in Gimme Shelter and what I always sort of understood, was I'm not saying he was doing anything criminal or anything that deserved the response that he got, but that it wasn't like he was just standing there next to his girlfriend doing nothing, is all I'm trying to say. And so whatever it was that they honed in on as being a justification for what happens next, is that's the first time in the middle of the song Under My Thumb, that's when the Hell's Angels first confront him, and they start punching him and kicking him, and according to some, that was the first time he got stabbed, right?
Yeah. So based on what people nearby told me, it seemed like one Hell's Angel approaches him and tries to yank him off the speaker box, and they have a little bit of a scuffle. And that's what kind of sets it off.
But he really, I mean, but they do punch him, and they do, is when they beat him up and they essentially push him back into the crowd. Like, you can't have that space. And somewhere in there, one of the Hell's Angels gets in one knife stabbing, right? He's not mortally wounded at that point.
In retrospect, it's not exactly clear when the kind of killing blow is issued. But what we see in the Maisel's footage, which is only about 8 seconds long, we see him stab twice. And we know that ultimately Meredith Hunter gets stabbed 5 times. So what we know visually of what happened is only part of what fully took place. A lot of which happened out of the view of the cameras filming the show.
Later on, when there's a trial, much is made about the fact that the poor Hell's Angels were just acting in self-defense. And that, as one person wrote to me on Twitter, you know, this is what you get when you bring a gun to a concert. He chose to bring a gun. And so security did what they had to do to protect the band. Or it would have been one shot away maybe from a dead Mick Jagger. What would you say to that?
That's the claim that's made. That's the legal claim that's made. So they're claiming self-defense, but not self-defense of themselves, but rather self-defense in the name of others, which is a very kind of particular California statute. And it's based on the claim that when they see Meredith Hunter with a gun, that someone shouts something like, he's going to kill Jagger. And that, you know, they jump out in the moment to protect Mick Jagger from this supposed assassin. There's nothing to back up that claim. And I think that it was a kind of savvy legal move by their lawyer during the court case, but not one that's based in any kind of reality, as far as I could tell. And I think that when it comes to the question of the gun, Meredith Hunter did have a gun. He did choose to bring it to the concert. I think that some of the helpful pieces of context for that, he was 18 years old. He made a bad decision. By every bit of evidence that I could get, the gun wasn't loaded. He brought it to the show in his car. He left it in the car. And then over the course of the day, as he and his girlfriend were watching the Hell's Angels beat people up and, you know, get into these nasty scuffles and assault people, at some point the two of them went back to his car. And I think his girlfriend had would have preferred to leave and go home. And he felt like, well, we're already here. We already, you know, kind of carved out this space near the stage. Let's be the headliner. And at that point, he decided to bring the gun back with him, presumably to kind of scare anyone off if they chose to kind of try to fight him.
Right.
You know, by no means is it a good decision, but I think the idea of Meredith Hunter as some kind of assassin in waiting is utterly ludicrous and doesn't seem to have any evidence to back it up.
Well, not to mention the fact that he'd already been beat up and stabbed at least once when he pulls the gun out. So who's acting in self-defense? It would be much more reasonable to say he was acting in self-defense to the Hells Angels.
The fight is clearly started by the Hells Angels. The fight is clearly ramped up by the Hells Angels. And I think that even if we choose to kind of take the line that's being presented here and say that Meredith Hunter somehow, you know, is the aggressor, which I think is very much incorrect, we can pause at the moment that he pulls out the gun and ask about the choices that were made even at that point.
Yeah.
So relatively soon after Meredith Hunter pulls out the gun is knocked away from him. And so let's imagine a different scenario in which trained security was, you know, providing their services on the day of the concert. At the point that you knock away a gun from someone and you've eliminated the weapon, that's a moment where you pause and you call the police. You detain the person who has caused the scuffle, which again I think is not a fair understanding of what took place. But even if it was, that's the moment where you say, okay, we've solved this problem. And clearly with the Hells Angels, that was not where they were going to stop. And so even after whatever threat Meredith Hunter might have provided is diffused, they go on assaulting him. You know, he's stabbed three more times. They find some sort of metal trash can lid and start beating him with it over and
stomping
over.
Stomping on him,
And they pull him out of sight. You know, it's a little bit hard for us to understand the physical space, but given that it was so crowded, there were actually kind of places within the concert space where people couldn't really see. And so the little bit that's recorded is what was able to be seen by the cameras and able a little bit to be seen by the people around. But the Hells Angels afterwards pull him out of sight and pretty much stab and beat him to the point of near death, not because there was any real threat anymore at this point, but just as far as we could tell, to prove a point.
Sure. And again, since as we know now from the record that he had, if the gun, even if the gun were loaded today, if you were in so many laws, in so many books, in so many states, if somebody came up and stabbed you twice, a stand your ground defense would be an affirmative defense for whatever happened after that. And so he would have been much more in the right, but here they were, the Hells Angels, drunk, high, racist, and pissed off. And they were going to take it all out on him. And they did. And he's dead.
And I do think that part of it as well is this, to my ears at least, really bizarre sense that often was offered by people who are part of the counterculture that, well, you should have known not to mess with the Hells Angels. And so part of that is, A, the Hells Angels often messed with people, right? They're the ones who start this fight. And then, but this sense that the Hells Angels were a kind of force of nature, that they just always did what they were going to do. You should know that they were going to be violent. You should know that they were going to be racist, almost as if to excuse their behavior, that they were what they were. No one could expect them to be anything otherwise. And therefore, you know, everyone should just kind of tiptoe accordingly around them. I always found that to be a very strange kind of understanding of things.
I think you're right. We won't give the numbers out yet, but we will. Saul Austerlitz out. I will get to the Friends conversation, though, too, coming up just a second, but let's wrap up the Stones first, next. So all of the bumpers we are playing are the same order that appeared that night when the Stones played live at Altamont. It's captured in the movie Gimme Shelter, but Saul Austerlitz has brought a fresh eye to the events in the book Just a Shot Away. He's also got a new book out about Friends. And there's a really interesting article about heavy metal groups in Russia, which we may talk about in just a second, too. But we'll wrap up this part about the Stones and a couple of the persistent legends of this death of Meredith Hunter coming up in just a minute on Coast to Coast. If you go to coasttocoastam.com, you'll see there's always fun links up there. If you want to know more, for example, about David Das Malchin, who we had on in the first hour, where he talked about his new graphic novel project, Count Crowley. It was such a fun first hour that I, if you didn't catch it, I hope your local radio station, your local affiliate, will replay that first hour after the show, as so many of them do. Saul Austerlitz will wait for your calls coming up next hour. We'll give you the numbers, not quite yet, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Saul Austerlitz, Just a Shot Away, Peace, Love, and Tragedy with the Rolling Stones at Altamont. So we know somewhere between the beatings, the stompings, the stabbings that Meredith Hunter dies. And the police do arrest one of the Hell's Angels, and there is a trial. But he, you know, found guilty, as you mentioned, on the grounds of self-defense because there had been some talk, even somebody screaming out about, you know, that he was going to try and, you know, kill Mick or something. But what about this rumor that had existed for so long that somehow after the concert, the Rolling Stones were the victims of or at least the focus of the Hell's Angels antipathy, and that at one point the Hell's Angels had put a contract out on Mick Jagger's life. Do you believe that?
That does seem to be true. There was a testimony before the U.S. Senate in the 1980s that indicated that the Hell's Angels had grown increasingly angry with the Rolling Stones in the aftermath of the show, feeling like they'd been hung out to dry or that the blame had been only cast on them. And for some reason, they were particularly angry with Mick Jagger. They felt like Keith Richards was, a nice guy or a normal guy, one that they could get along with, but that Mick Jagger had somehow upset them or had allowed them to take the blame without redirecting it or explaining it away. And so the story goes, at least, that they had made two attempts on Mick Jagger's life, one of them on the street in New York, and one of them in a kind of failed mock comic attempt to storm his house in the Hamptons by water. Neither of them really got anywhere, but there does seem to be some evidence indicating that genuinely took place.
So they're storming it by water, meaning that they were using ski-dos? They were.
I think they were trying to take a boat to get there, and then
okay.
Sank. So they did not get very far.
I'd like to see the Hell's Angels on Wave Runners, wearing flotation vests that say Hell's Angels on the back as they're coming up on the beach. This poor guy Meredith Hunter is buried in a pauper's grave. An unmarked grave, essentially, for years. And I like the fact that at the very beginning of the story, aren't you the one that brings attention to the family that there's finally a marker there?
Yes. I mean, it had been reported in the news, but...
But they didn't know about it.
Yeah, I think that Meredith's death was so tragic and strange and unexpected and at the same time very much of a piece with their family story, that they felt overwhelmed by the details. And so after the funeral, they didn't really visit his grave. You know, Meredith was a presence in their lives. He was someone that they thought about every day, still think about every day. But I think that the idea of going to a place where his body was at rest was just too overwhelming for them. And so even though he was buried not all that far from where they live, it just wasn't something that they were doing regularly. And so when it's in a kind of interesting story, a documentary filmmaker had ended up making a short film about his gravesite, where he went and visited, spoke to like one of the people who works at the cemetery, and talking about life and death and tragedy, you know, not exclusively about Meredith Hunter's experience, but about those more general ideas. And as a result, the filmmaker decided that he would try to raise some money to put up a headstone, or, you know, to put up a stone for Meredith Hunter,
right,
to mark the place where he was buried. And so by the time that I visited, there was a stone there, but for, you know, 40 plus years, there had been nothing.
Interesting. So I think it was Mick Jagger, for whatever it's worth, that had commented that it, and maybe this is something that people often also associate with the Tate-LaBianca murders, but somehow the stabbing of Meredith Hunter at Altamont sort of bookended the 60s as a period of you know, peace, love, and understanding, and that that this was, this revealed the darker side, or the some kind of devolution of the movement that had inspired them to have a free concert in the symbolic place of the, you know, all of the flower children in San Francisco. And so in a way that kind of killed the whole hippie movement when Meredith Hunter died. Where are you with that?
I think that's a convenient argument, but not one that I entirely buy. You know, I think, first of all, it's convenient to say that it's the death of the 60s. Just chronologically, given that this is a concert that takes place on December 6th, 1969, so it is the end of the 60s one way or the other. I think that, you know, one of the things that I think about is a story that someone told me about being a journalist on tour with the Stones during the 69 tour, and coming to places like Auburn, Alabama, you know, which were not hotbeds of hippiedom at the time, but encountering young people who wanted to be hippies and didn't know anything about it really yet, and kind of came up to people involved in the show to ask them more about what it was all about. And so I think the point is that the 60s rolled out at different times in different places. And so, you know, clearly they were already happening and flourishing in places like San Francisco, but I think in other places, the 60s didn't start happening until the 1970s.
Well,
so I don't think that the 60s come to an end with Meredith Hunter's death. I think they go on in a lot of ways well into the 70s. But I do think that the idea that somehow this was the end of things is in some senses a reflection of the ways in which the counterculture was unaware or tried to maintain a lack of awareness about some of the larger societal problems that they were glossing over. You know, the story of race and racism in America long predated Altamont and continues on long afterwards. And so, again, I think this reflects in some ways that for a lot of the people involved with the show, the story of the show is about one particular thing, about the counterculture, about youth ascendant, and but in reality, one of the major things that the show is about, or that the story of Altamont is ultimately about, is about the story of racism in America, which is not something that they particularly wanted to engage with or something that they were doing much thinking about.
That type of view from 30,000 feet is also what helps people understand just how successful the TV show Friends both was in first run and is in reruns and will be when they do this new movie coming up, which, you know, all Friends fans are upside down about. You write about that in Generation Friends, and the subtitle is An Inside Look at the Show That Defined a Television Era. What era are we talking about?
Well, I was interested, as someone who grew up in the 90s, I was interested in the television of the 1990s. But the thing that got me most focused on writing this book was realizing that there was an entirely new wave of younger viewers who were embracing the show, that there were 14 and 15 and 16-year-olds who often weren't alive when the show first went on the air, sometimes weren't alive when the show went off the air, and yet were finding the show relevant to them, that it spoke to them, that it was a show that they were arguing about and thinking about and obsessing over as if it was, you know, the brand new hottest thing on television and not, you know, an almost 25-year-old television show. And so just that phenomenon alone I found fascinating, and I really wanted to understand how a TV show could survive like that and, you know, become something that engaged entirely new generations of fans.
I teach a class in media management and entrepreneurship, and one of the themes in the class is how entertainment products, including the news, are driven by demographics. That it's important to know who your audience is and to know the finer points of that audience, even if you're talking about it in just kind of the big picture, big concept kind of thing about what a generation is. Because if you're lucky, you'll have a show like Friends, which in many ways just defined the millennial experience in the United States, the idea, or even the Gen X story of, you know, people who were growing up at a time when they were latchkey kids, and they created their own family groups, and then this is why they could look at something like Friends and it totally resonated with them, but also why millennials like it too, for very much the same reason. So at least in some part explains the popularity of it when it first ran, and then also later on in reruns, because it speaks to both of those some of the characteristics of both of those generations.
And I think it speaks to a certain kind of fantasy or ideal about what it means to be a young adult. You know, if you're a teenager, I think that you know that you're going to be an adult soon, but you don't necessarily always have the fullest possible sense of what that means or what that entails. So looking at a show like Friends, it provides a kind of preview of the landscape where you see, you know, first jobs, first relationships, first heartbreak, maybe getting married, maybe having children. You kind of get, you're granted a sense of what young adulthood consists of. And obviously, it's a fantasy, right? It's a fantasy in which all of these things happen, and yet you spend all of your time with your friends. You're having breakfast with your friends every morning. But I do think that there is a sense of it providing a kind of template for the future that speaks particularly to teenagers and younger people.
Have you done much looking at this new generation that's coming up, Generation Z?
Yeah, so over the course of researching this book, I ended up speaking to a lot of the crew and writers from the show, and so they're now all, generally speaking, roughly in their 50s. And so a lot of them, without my even asking, told me variations of the same story, which was that, you know, their teenage son or daughter had started watching Friends, often hadn't even realized that their parents had worked on the show, had belatedly discovered that, and, you know, that they, the parents, had won all of this added cachet with their teenagers by virtue of them realizing that they had created this thing that they and all of their friends were still really deeply engaged with and enjoying and feeling like it spoke to to them in particular. So that to me is fascinating because, you know, so many of the shows of that era, which are still great, are not necessarily ones that connect with fans who are 16 today. Like, I loved Seinfeld, but there are not a ton of 16-year-old Seinfeld fans out there in 2019. And so Friends is this highly unusual exception that proves the rule in that sense that, you know, for Gen Z in particular, I think there's a real there's a sense that, you know, popular culture mostly consists of things from the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And Friends is really the one of the major exceptions to that as a much, much older show that a lot of them see as belonging to them, and that I think they'd be surprised to even hear or experience that older fans might have any connection with it.
I asked because I was interested in this whole OK Boomer thing, which has gotten all this traction in the news, where Gen Z, so after the Generation Z, roughly defined as children who were born or young adults that were born after 1996. Again, all of those numbers are, you know, we kind of put them in pencil, but roughly the later part of the 1990s. And now that they're in college, or we're seeing the first graduates of Generation Z going out into the world, that they have this particular dislike of baby boomers. And it started this kind of generational war, which I don't think we've seen for a while, because millennials got along really well with baby boomers, but the Gen Z aren't. And there's that show Daybreak, where it's a zombie show on Netflix, where all the zombies are all baby boomers who just walk around muttering about tasks that need to be done around the house. And the people who are non-zombies are all the Generation Z people. And I think this is, I'm always curious how the relationship between this kind of generational understanding of what generations look for in their entertainment products are reflected in what actually gets made and then shown back to them. And of those, which ones become major hits?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting question. And it is this kind of filtering that happens where, you know, the entirety of an era of entertainment that people who are alive and aware of it experience in its totality becomes filtered down into one or two or three representatives of the entirety of that era. And so Friends kind of winning out that battle is not necessarily what I would have guessed or anticipated, but it's clear that for a huge swath of younger fans, when they think about the American popular culture of the 1990s, Friends is one of the very first things that comes
to mind. Yeah, in fact, I can't really think of a show that rivals it.
No, there aren't really any. I mean, I think for you know, older fans, things like Seinfeld or The Simpsons might occupy a similar space, but those are not as much on the radar of younger fans. You know, I teach college students, and Friends is very much something that is still that they still engage with. Sometimes they're a little bit embarrassed about it when they're, you know, on the hipper end. But yeah, those other shows don't. From the era don't penetrate to the same extent anymore.
And if you're talking about sitcoms from the 80s, you know, there were a bunch you could choose from. You know, there were that sort of were emblematic of that generation. You know, The Cosby Show, Roseanne, Newhart, you know, Designing Women. There's a bunch of them that live on in reruns, but also, you know, they did really, really well in their time slot and in their day. But just in terms of being remembered and what a cultural marker, like Friends, it's much harder to think of anything from the 90s that had anywhere close to that impact, even though they were trying very hard at NBC to find some other show that would do as well. Well, all the networks where everybody wanted their own Friends. All right, well, this is, I promised you we'd get to a conversation about that new book, because it's really good too. It just, that the book about the Rolling Stones and the death at Altamont, you can jump in on that if you have questions for Saul Austerlitz. We'll also talk about heavy metal in Russia, too, in between the phone calls. So now's your chance. We'll give you the numbers here at after the top of the hour, and you can join in the conversation on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.